do you like the Star Wars?
Nub nub, we do.
Nub nub, indeed. Wow. I'm not sure how I feel about that, but I guess I should feel it's rather appropriate considering where we're headed today. I'm, of course, Cole Jedi Cole Houston, and you are?
I'm Eddie, the Ewok Whisperer Medina.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm coming with it tonight.
You are? Dang. We are here to do something we haven't done in far too long, and that's to actually produce an actor profile.
Yeah.
Every now and again, we're like, hey, you know, we haven't talked about a specific character, a specific actor, or what have you.
It's like, did you just set up your lightsaber display?
I did.
I wonder if I can hear it. I'm sure our audience can hear it.
Yeah, it was quite by accident, but I did indeed. Things got a mind of its own sometimes. That was my Force FX lightsaber display that apparently once resided in a Walmart somewhere in this great land of ours.
Yeah. I like the actor studies because we get to talking so much very specifically about Star Wars, the universe of Star Wars, that it's nice to do the actor profiles because it allows us to reach into other realms other than Star Wars.
Yeah, and kind of dig into some of the other aspects of these actors' careers.
Yeah.
So at this point, we're going to be talking a lot about none other than Warwick Davis, who, through a happy accident, gets one of the plum roles of the Star Wars.
Oh, yeah. Very much so. I mean, His portrayal of Wicket is quite honestly legendary. It's though some fans were much maligned about the Ewoks, others just really took a liking to Wicket and the Ewoks. And if anything else, it definitely captured the attention of a lot of young kids that were drifting into Star Wars that necessarily weren't there in 77, you know?
Exactly. I think that, you know, as the Ewoks go, Wicket, because Wicket is a character, a hero character, as it were, you really want this character to kind of capture the imagination of everybody. Yeah. And what's fascinating is Warwick Davis's grandmother sees an ad that some production company is wanting extras who are, I think, 2 foot something or less. Or I forget what the exact.
I don't think
4 feet or under.
Yeah, there. I was going to say, there you go.
Because meters is because he was English. But yeah, that's one of the things that's fascinating is Grandma sees this ad and says, you know, I'm not going to pretend to be like, hello, Warwick. But, you know. He goes and gets cast as an Ewok.
Well, and that almost didn't happen because he told a story later on. I hadn't heard of this until way later. I heard the grandmother aspect of it early on. Maybe it was in one of those making of documentaries, but he said that she was a little hesitant to bring it up to his mom because she was thinking like the mom would be worried that it was going to be exploitive because of his height, you know, maybe this wasn't going to be a good idea to her. So grandma was almost like a little hesitant to the point where she almost didn't approach her with the information.
Well, that's interesting.
And thank goodness she did.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, because through a strange, happy accident, as it were, this little kid who was very young at the time. I forget. It was like
11, I think.
11, yeah, is that right?
I think.
And so he gets cast as just a background Ewok, one of dozens of Ewoks wandering around the forest, which, I mean, at that age, how cool is it to get cast in a Star Wars film? He was already a fan, reportedly.
Oh, yeah. He said that when he went to the I guess the quote casting agent, where he said it didn't really feel like a casting agent setting. They ushered him into a room with a lady he assumed was one of the casting agents or producers, and she said, she looked him up and down, and she said, "Are you a Star Wars fan?" And he said very excitedly, "Oh, yes, I am." And she was like, "Oh, great." She said, and she scribbled out his instructions. She's like, "On this day, go to this place. They're going to fit you for your costume, and you're going to be an Ewok." And he's like, "What is an Ewok?" And she's like, "Well, don't worry about it. Just you'll know what it is once you get fitted for the once you get your costume." And they ushered him off. It was that simple and easy. And you know, it's kind of bizarre. You kind of wonder if that would have flown in this day and age, because everyone is a little bit more careful when it comes to minors on set.
Yeah.
And with him being 11, maybe 12, he was born in 1970, so I guess if they started filming in 82 or 81, whenever, 11 or 12-year-old, you would think that would be almost, well, you know, you're a minor. I think we got – oh, in fact, this was another little aspect of – he did a talk one time with in front of at a university in front of a lot of students, and he mentioned another aspect of the – hiring process I had not heard in previous tellings, and that was when mom actually reached out and contacted this person, the number, they said, "Well, we're already full. We already reached our quota." So he hadn't even gotten to the part of going in, but it was either that they went anyway and it all kind of worked out, where I guess he was just too adorable not to take on.
Yeah, you don't want to turn away the little kid.
Right, right.
Well, that and the funny thing is that I've been watching the documentary Elstree 1976, which is, of course, many years earlier, but yeah. It seems like in the late 70s, early 80s, the casting for a lot of these productions was just pretty freewheeling. You know, the minor, at least for the extras and background stuff, they were just like, you know, it'd be like a sign tacked to a wall and pointing to an alleyway.
You're like,
either I'm going to get a part.
A little sketchy almost.
Yeah, it's like, I'm either going to get a part or I'm going to get murdered. And, you know, at this point, it would work out either way. But.
My gosh, what a difficult
actor. Yeah, that poor guy. Then, you know, he goes on to become like a background rebel who gets to sign autographs at celebrations now. And we're all jealous, but, you know, it was worth it. He took the chance to get his throat slit. But, you know, I think it really was just kind of a very loose, freewheeling kind of thing, where now, they, you know, unless you had an agent, they wouldn't even as an extra almost. Nobody wants to look at you. Right. So... That in itself is fascinating, but how cool for a little British kid to all of a sudden, you know, not only get cast in a Star Wars film, in a franchise he already loves, and then on top of that, they fly him to California.
Right.
Way up to Northern California, to the Redwood Forest, and, you know, plop him in the middle of all these stormtroopers and the core cast, for God's sake. I mean,
yeah,
his role, everything, if you really think about it, even as an extra, it had to be amazingly cool.
Oh, of course.
If you cared about Star Wars.
Yeah, and he said when he got on set that first day and he saw the actors, he said in his child mind, he was actually seeing his heroes. Like he said, he saw Luke Skywalker and Han and Chewie and Leia. He said he wasn't seeing Mark Hamill, Harrison Ford, Carrie Fisher. He said in his mind, these were his heroes that he was seeing for the previous 4 years of his life. And, it must have been amazing, you know, just to be suddenly dropped into that. Let's take it a little bit more personal, because Cole, both you and I have been in extras in movies.
Yes.
So you brought up a good point where this is a major franchise. At this point, two sequels, two blockbusters. It's not like this is casting for the first movie no one knew what it was going to be. You knew what Return of the Jedi was going to be.
Yeah, at that point, or Revenge of the Jedi.
Right, and it was still...
How amazing.
It was still... almost like so loose and free. How difficult was it for you to get your part in the movie you were in? Was it? What I'm, I guess
was,
what I'm trying to say is,
it was a weird little
thing. It was
probably
more difficult than what he had to do.
In a way, it was kind of a strange little mix. A friend of ours had mentioned that we'd gone to lunch with some friends, and she had mentioned, one of her friends mentions, there's a movie shooting, a little indie film shooting down in San Antonio.
And what's it called again?
The name of the film was Now Hiring.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
And by director Mark Cantu, who since moved out of Texas and on to bigger and better things, I'm sure. But this was one of his early films. Mm-hmm. And he'd done a short version of this that showed at a convention down in San Antonio.
Yeah.
And he was looking for, there, you know, kind of, it was, seemed to be, you know, people enjoyed it. So he expanded the script and expanded the scope. And they were looking for extras to appear as the worst possible superheroes you could imagine.
Yeah. And think American Idol, but in superhero world.
Basically. Exactly, because it was essentially the HR department trying to hire a new superhero for a team.
Yeah.
That was about all we knew, but they had to be really ridiculous because it was a comedy. It was sort of like it was mostly being played for laughs.
Yeah.
And they weren't going to be able to go down for this. The timing was all wrong. But they mentioned it to me because I had a character I developed called the Mighty Placeholder that they thought, you know, you should contact them and go down for that. And we were always looking for excuses to go to San Antonio anyway. And so, oddly enough, Mrs. Jedi Cole couldn't make the trip, and I would go down, I stayed with her cousins, and got up one morning, went to this big high-rise office building, and met all these incredible people who were
yeah.
brilliant characters that they'd come up with, and there's just not time to talk about. But my favorite was the guy who could see through fish. I thought that was in the history of superheroes. But
what's his name? See-through? S-E-A?
Oh,
See-through?
It was brilliant. This kid's like 16-year-old kid. He's like, I'm the Blue Streak. I can see through fish.
Oh, okay.
Completely unconnected. And he and I actually share a scene in the finished film.
Yeah.
And then Mark had posted that he was shooting the finale in the in the meantime, this was about 6 or 8 months later, I had the good fortune to be invited to go have dinner with Camden Toy and Marilyn Gigliotti with Jeffrey Carlton from Alcon.
Yeah.
And at dinner, I had realized from watching the post for Now Hiring that Camden Toy was the villain in Now Hiring.
Wow.
And I said, you and I are in the same movie. He's like, what are you talking about? I said, and Now Hiring. He goes, oh, my God, they haven't. I go down later this year to film my scenes. They've already done the makeup casting, life cast. And sure enough, I went down for the finale and turned out to be the weekend before he was coming down. And Catherine and I went, and I got to double as one of the thugs. And so I appear in several shots of the film, ultimately. And then I went back down. I asked her cousins were like, come back down next week. And I actually got to see Camden Toy in full costume and makeup. And
wow.
It was such a fun experience. You know, a lot of just sitting around waiting and watching.
So basically, it sounds like you went through a lot. It wasn't a lot of trouble to get cast, but it seems like you went through a lot more trouble than what Warwick Davis had to get cast. And
yeah, pretty much. I just, you know, you went down and they were taking all comers, but it turned out there were so many of us. From the second I got in there, I'm like, no, not all of us are going to appear on screen.
Yeah, yeah. So it was a little trickier then.
Yeah, and, you know, I did this whole little bit and a few seconds of it make it on screen.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm still. It's fun to go back and watch that. It's a fun little film. It's not a great film, but it's not a bad film in the least. And it's a neat concept. And the core actors on there were just wonderful people. They were all so generous and all so giving of their time to everybody on the set. When, you know, things got rough, they would, like, you know, hey, you know, we know you guys aren't getting paid, but you guys are doing a great job.
Yeah. Well, Colleen and I were zombies in the zombie movie Degenerates. And it wasn't too difficult to get cast because the producer of the movie I used to work with, her and I used to work, she was the at a Six Flags, she was the foreman in the games department, and I was her assistant foreman. So we already knew each other from way back, as she mentioned, hey, I'm producing a zombie movie, we need extras, you want to be a zombie? It's like, yeah, but it was as difficult as making sure you wore the right wardrobe and that you didn't mind it getting beat up and cut up and dustied and bloodied up. That was the extent of us getting into the Degenerates, and it was a pretty awesome experience to film all those scenes and to see a car nearly flip over into a ravine for the big action scene and all that.
Oh,
that,
nice.
That being said, it probably was much easier for Warwick Davis to get cast as an Ewok than it was for me to get cast as a zombie in this movie.
No, it seems like, yeah, and this was a major Hollywood production.
So. Exactly, yeah.
But what's funny is that the part of Wicket, the actual, you know, hero role, mm-hmm. was to go to Kenny Baker.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I remember, like, back in the 80s, the story was out there. Mm-hmm. Even, you know, well before the internet, we all got to hear about, a lot of the goings on. Of course, the legendary story was that Kenny Baker got sick from eating a chili dog the day before.
I knew he got food poisoning. I didn't realize it was a chili dog.
Well, I don't know how accurate that is. Real thing is that, in this more modern world where we can look up everything, I'm a little dubious about the chili dog aspect.
Yeah, he was asked one time if he had anything to do with it, because this would have been well past the statute of limitations on something like that. And, yeah. And all he replied was, it was money well spent.
Yeah, but the story was that, here he is just like, you know, doing his thing as a background Ewok.
Yeah.
And he apparently caught Lucas's eye by the mannerisms that he brought to the character.
Yeah.
And that he would kind of, you know, fidget around and bob his head. And apparently he was mimicking the way his dog mm-hmm. would act in that way that, you know, what.
And that's a good way to approach that role.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's why he comes across so well. And it's kind of funny how sometimes these a lot of people who are effectively non-actors mm-hmm. Bring so much to the background role. And in this case, doing what Rich Hall Sniglitz referred to as a funch, where a dog kind of tilts its head in a questioning way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've had dogs that do that. And what really sold him with Lucas was his ability to be able to stick his tongue out through the little mouth slit.
Oh, yeah. I think that's kind of very distinctive of his character as well.
Right. He figured out, and he wasn't seeing the other actors do it. It's just something he thought he felt natural for that particular role. And I guess it caught everyone's attention. They thought it was so cute. And it's so funny because Kenny Baker's going to get sick. And they're going to have to replace him, like, spur of the moment the day of. But there must have been something special about Warwick that he stood out from all those other Ewoks that they did that. And that's the thing you forget, is that these prior to the tinkering of the digital tinkering on the film, these are just static masks. You know, there's no blinking, there's no movement of the mouths, there's no nostril flaring. There's nothing to them, so
yeah.
All the characterization has to be brought out through mannerisms, through the body language. And I think that's where he had a few steps above the other Ewok extras. You know, no offense to the friends of ours on Facebook who played Ewoks as well, but I'm sure the tongue thing sold it. I mean, if your ability to have a A Talented Tongue is either going to land you the role of an Ewok or in the adult film industry. Either one. Thankfully, he ended up as an Ewok.
Especially at his age. You know, all we'd need is a male version.
That's true. That's true. We don't need a...
You don't need a male version of Tracy Lords out there.
There it is. I couldn't think of her name. Tracy Lords. I'm not as well versed in the adult film industry as you are, Cole.
Well, you know, I had an extra part in another film I won't talk about.
Was that the film Size Matters Not?
Oh, wow. Thanks. No, it was Working the Merkins. little rancor pit in joke there. But one thing that's kind of fun is, I believe with the timing of this is before they all shipped off to California to shoot the stuff in the U.S. During a lot, because stuff like Jabba's Palace was filmed in England, and they suited, you know, I guess once the casting was official, which kind of makes it, or this may have been after, I'm not sure, because it really has a lot to do with where the... You know, the timing of Warwick Davis's actual casting as, you know, in favor of a sickly Kenny Baker. There's a great little piece called Return of the Ewok, a little short film that one of the assistant directors produced.
Oh, and I haven't heard of this.
Oh, it's fun. It's Warwick Davis in full costume wandering around, like, bugging Mark Hamill, Harrison Ford, Carrie Fisher.
Oh, I have seen this. I didn't know it had a proper name, though.
Yeah, okay. And then he kind of wanders onto the set of
Yes.
And what's so cool is you see some of the background actors you don't really see in that very crowded palace.
That's right. And that's what's the Return of the Ewok, you said?
Yeah. The best way to find it is Return of the Ewok.
It's funny because I forgot about that, but that does sound very familiar.
Yeah, that's a fun little thing to see. So I don't know if that was shot maybe after they came back and were doing the studio. It seems likely they would have done the location stuff first anyway.
Sure.
Now that I give it a think. But it's kind of fun because... You've got all the characters, some of them in costume and in character, some of them in costume as themselves, and it's just Warwick Davis doing what he does very well, and that's being Wicket.
Right.
He brings so much to that little character.
Yeah.
The fact that he's seemingly a little smaller than Kenny Baker as well.
He said at the time of filming he was, I think he said he was 2'11", if I'm not mistaken. It's if I remember correctly from my research. So just under 3 foot tall.
Yeah.
And so he wouldn't grow much more once he hit adulthood. I think he's like 3'6" or 3'8" now. Yeah. But yeah, one story that I remember hearing way back. And this is a true story because in more recent interviews, he has retold the story again, is how when he was on set, and of course the cast just really took a liking to him.
Yeah.
Mark, and of course being an 11, 12-year-old boy, Star Wars fan, obviously, Mark Hamill asked him if there are any Star Wars figures that he was missing. And he goes, oh, well, yeah, sure. He goes, well, write them down, and I'll see what I can do. So he proceeds to write down everything that he needs, which was apparently a pretty massive list, because it also would have included, I guess, by that point, all the waves of Empire as well.
Yeah, and all 54.
Yeah, he said he said he gave it to Mark Hamill, and he said he made this face that he interpreted, I guess, like a smile and a chagrin or whatever, and he interpreted it as either it was, boy, this kid is a bull little SOB, or he's like, he was really impressed with my handwriting skills. One of the two. And I love that. And that's, just to get off on a tangent real quick, that's what I love about Warwick Davis is that if you listen to him in interviews, he is such a funny, warm, hearted person.
He's such a generous, genuine is the word. Yeah. Word, genuine person.
He is.
And he really, I think, having seen him interviewed many times and seeing him live at Celebration, we went into this massive auditorium in this massive convention center in Florida. And, you know, we stood in this queue line with probably 2,000 people.
Uh-huh.
And it was just so engaging to listen to the man speak. And he was having so much fun. He had one like a little what do they call that stupid thing that used to be all the rage, the little two-wheeler.
The little scooter
thing you run around on.
Yeah.
And whoever was moderating this panel, they even, like, took a moment to have it. Somebody suggested they do a shot of him running over the host. And so they staged this thing where it looked like he's like, oh, no, I've run over the host.
That's
like a little photo op, you know?
Right. He's so entertaining to watch. I absolutely love this guy. I love listening to him. So Mark Hamill, then, he gives him the list, and Mark Hamill goes off, and I guess however many days later, he surprises him with a box, opens a box. Not only has he fulfilled his wish...
Blonde Santa.
I know, his wish list of the figures he needed... But he had in there, like, some the play sets. He said it had the Millennium Falcon, which he didn't have, and the Darth Vader.
There's a box.
Right, the Darth Vader case for the figures. And he said he still has the stuff. He still has it in his personal collection. So that's just such a cool story. I mean, that just really shows.
Well, and, you know, as collectors both, one of the things I love, and I tried to do a little thing years ago in the United States of Geekdom, where I was doing a segment called Show Me Yours.
Yeah.
And I wanted people not only to send in pictures of their collection, but send some stories about things. There are so many places where you can look at somebody's collection. It's like, oh, that's great. I want to know what are some of the fun stories behind parts of your collection if I'm going to publish. And that's just so neat to have, you know, this childhood collection that has a greater, most amazing memory behind it.
Yeah, you were given a Luke Skywalker figure by Luke Skywalker himself.
Exactly.
I mean, that's cooler than taking your Luke Skywalker figure to get signed by Luke Skywalker, I think.
Exactly.
There's more to it. And he has a great, great Carrie Fisher story. That she would apparently fret over his well-being on set because he was in that hot costume. And apparently it was very hot, given the time of year and all. And he was taking it in stride, he said. But he said quickly, she started, as soon as they would cut and he would take the head off, she started bringing him chocolate milk and cookies. To kind of give him like that little boost to like kind of make him feel better, make sure he was taken care of. This was coming not from a PA or anybody. It was coming from Carrie Fisher.
From the star.
Right. And he said she was really going out of her way to look after him. And he goes, he picked up on this real quick. So what he said he started doing was when they would cut, he would start hamming it up more. It's like, oh, he started fanning himself. Oh, my gosh. Oh, I'm so – he would really ham it up to where she would – give him a little more TLC, you know? And I was like, I would have done the same thing.
Oh, yeah, game the system, baby.
Right. Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, you can see kind of in that the germ of the man he would become.
Yeah, yes, yes.
Because he just has this wonderfully wicked or wicket, if you will.
Hence the name of this episode, Something Wicked This Way Comes.
The sense of self-deprecating humor. And, you know, I can be incredibly self-deprecating myself, and I have tremendous respect for anyone who doesn't take themselves too seriously.
Oh, he's a master of that. If you've seen Life's Too Short, which we can get into later in this
episode. Yes, definitely will be getting into that.
Oh, if you haven't caught
yet. Need to know this thing.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, to take it back to Return of the Jedi. So they, Is there any more backstory, any more behind the scenes stories? Because I wanted to jump into the Ewok movies just a little bit.
Let's go ahead and do that, because I mean, how cool is it? This would have been such just a one off. This was the end of the line.
Yes,
for this part of the series, as far as anyone knows.
Yeah, and then I'm sure at some point, just the shock of, we're not done with you yet. We want you to star in this movie specifically about the Ewoks.
Yeah.
And he said he really has to thank George Lucas's daughter, because she apparently fell head over heels in love with the Ewoks, and in particular Wicket the Ewok. So, I'm sorry, Wicket W. Warwick, as his name is properly. And
yes, the only, he's like the David S. Pumpkins of Ewoks.
Is that only on the action figure packaging, by the way, or is that in the?
That was the first place I encountered. Actually, I stand corrected. I may have seen that in print somewhere.
Right.
And it was just, even back then, it was just shudder-inducing.
Right. He was the World Wide Web before there was a World Wide Web, because
WWW.
Yeah, right. But yeah, well, I remember seeing the figure and seeing it said Wicket W. Warwick, and I thought, well, I know the actor's last name is Warwick. That's pretty clever, and I only know that because Vic was, you know, a little older than me, and he knew that and said, you know, his
Warwick. Yeah, and I can't help but think that was sort of a nod to Warwick Davis, because he's the only Ewok with not only a last name,
yeah, of course,
a middle, you know. Wicket has a middle initial now, so are the weeds on the Seawalk. But the thing about it is, another little kind of side note on Wicket, since you brought up the action figure, there was a Wicket, you know, back in the 80s when Steve and I were, my friend Steve and I were looking around for different Star Wars figures, and we were, I think this may have been at like Best Products in Dunkin'.
Oh,
and we passed this couple in the midst of this argument about, I think that like she knew what she was talking about, and he didn't realize she was talking about an Ewok. And she was like, it's Wicket. He goes, no, Wicked. Like her English wasn't that good. He's like, no, Wicked. Or Wicket. He goes, no, it's Wicket. So that kind of stuck for quite a while.
I think I remember you telling me this story, probably off mic.
Yeah. He's like, Wicked, Wicked. So I had to bring that
it's
in.
Like, it's like that Seinfeld bit. Is it salsa or salsa? Salsa,
oh, that's salsa. Right. It must be impossible for a Spanish person to order salsa.
Yeah, salsa.
Salsa.
Yeah, I wanted salsa, not salsa. Salsa.
Salsa. Wow, that's a great salsa. Deep cut there. That's usually my job.
But, so he's thinking he's done, and he probably had the time of his life, and you're thinking, where do you go from here? What do you do? So imagine his elation to find out that he gets to play Wicket again in an Ewok movie, and then not even knowing at the time that there would be two movies, you know.
Exactly.
And that was amazing.
Courage, and then what is the other one? Oh, hell, another Ewok movie, or something like that, I'm pretty sure.
With apologies to a friend of the show, Eric Walker, for
sorry.
Played Mace in both movies.
That's not my thing. Sorry, Eric.
But, I think that speaks a lot to him as an actor, how he conveyed Wicket. Because those movies are based around, I mean, of course, they're based around Mace and Sindel.
Yeah.
But Wicket is the
other principal character.
Right.
Everybody else is supporting, even Uncle Gundy there, or whatever his name was.
Okay, I should know this, but do they speak English in that movie, the Ewoks?
The original, they do not. I don't know about the second one, because back in the United States of Geekdom days, I had an idea for an event for AllCon. We would do prior to United States of Geekdom, back in the VaderCast days, my first podcast, I had this idea, let's do a Mystery Science Theater riff of Caravan of Courage and call it VaderCast versus the Ewoks. When I sat down to begin writing this, I'd never seen the damn things. And I'm 20 minutes in and realize this is untenable. There's nothing to hang jokes on because you can't have, like, Low-Grey going, and it's like, that's what she said. You know, that there's, you have to have a common language to do parody.
Yeah.
And there, I didn't know any Ewok jokes.
Well, okay, the Battle for Endor, he speaks broken English, it says here. I should know this because I've seen those movies more recently, but in the first one, he does not. What's that?
It just made it worse.
Here's a funny side note. When you type in anything asking any questions about the Ewoks, one of the main questions that pops up is Chewbacca an Ewok? That's one of the most asked questions on Google when people are looking up things about Ewoks.
Despite the fact that in the Star Wars he's referred to as a Wookiee, we still need to check.
Right.
Because mate Wookiee is just sort of a PC term for big-ass Ewok.
Right. Exactly. Oh, my gosh. But, again, he embraces that role in both the Ewok movies. I still think they're fun movies. I really do like watching them. I particularly like the second one. I think it's a little higher quality as far as the creature designs and the special effects and the pacing of the movie overall. It doesn't drag as much as the first one.
Yeah, I think by the second one they realized that this was something that was going to be viable for television.
Right, right.
And they probably put a lot more into it as a result. Right.
Exactly. I mean, it had great production value for a made-for-TV. Well, actually, wasn't the first one released in theaters, like, abroad? I think it was.
I think it may have been, like, as the Ewok movie.
Yeah, overseas.
And then it got renamed the Caravan of Courage or rebranded or what have you. And then what's amazing about this is, okay, so you get this kid who really impresses Lucas to the point of he gets his costume self moved to the forefront.
Yeah.
Becomes a name character with an actual several scenes and several shots. He gets to interact directly with Carrie Fisher and directly with Kenny Baker. And I believe he actually gets to hump Harrison Ford's leg.
That's been a story out there, yeah.
because I mean as I would hump his leg. I'm that big a fan. But, you know, that ruins my chances of ever meeting Harrison Ford.
Right.
Like, you know, they went from nothing to less than nothing. In that instance. So much for that. But the thing about it is, to not only impress the director to that level, you know, speaking to, like, being an extra in the film, there was a shot in Now Hiring where the blue streak is just basically blasted by this other hero and runs off crying. And I just decided when he runs, you know, I'm standing there next to him and he runs off. I'm just kind of look down the hall like, what the hell was that all about?
Yeah.
And then we cut and the director and Mark comes over. He's like, do that again. And then look over here at Captain Crow's feet and just like, do your eyes like crybaby.
Oh, gosh.
So it was a fun, you know, it's a stupid little thing, but when you bring a little something extra and it gets recognized.
Right.
You know, that just made it so much the more fun to be a part of it. So, you know, to get pulled up to the forefront like that, and then, you know, like you say, reprise the role not once but twice for the small screen. Mm-hmm. And then 4 years after that,
yeah,
who comes knocking at your door but Ron Howard on the recommendation of George Lucas?
Yeah, and apparently on the set, as they're wrapping filming on Return of the Jedi, Lucas had pulled Warwick Davis's mom aside and mentioned to her that he's got something in mind for him, but he's too young right now. He goes, I'm going to give it a few more years once he gets older. I've got something in mind that he would be perfect for. And of course that was Willow.
Yes. And how amazing to go from just a kid whose grandma sees an ad looking for diminutive extras.
Yeah.
To essentially getting a starring role in a major motion picture as a someone who started out as a non-actor.
Exactly. Exactly. So, how was his role in Willow? I have yet to see the movie, and I know people like are aghast that I have not seen it.
It's like that, when I say, no, I haven't seen the Clone Wars. You know, I just haven't seen it.
Yeah.
This is 1988, and I have to say, this is a period, let me see if I can get my bearings here, because I don't want to do this wrong. Because you did actually recently see a movie I'm going to... So this is nearly a decade after Time Bandits, which is another movie people were aghast you hadn't seen.
I've seen it, though. I have seen it.
I finally saw it. But the thing about it is, Willow was like Time Bandits in that it brought a lot of little people into a film that you recognized from things. And a lot of these guys were Ewoks.
Right. I heard with all the extras, as far as little people, that they brought in over 300 extras on set. Can you imagine?
God, not since The Wizard of Oz have you seen a cast of characters that big.
What?
I mean, literally, that the sheer volume. And I think that might not be far off the mark, because it was sort of like... in the way that Star Wars grew out of Lucas's desire to do Flash Gordon.
Yeah.
And being unable to get the license, it's almost like Willow was kind of his love letter to Tolkien.
Really?
Because Willow Offgood, if I remember correctly, is the character's last name, is a... God, what were they? I'm trying to remember the it was cool. Nelwyn.
And is that their species?
Is that I love the fact that it's not, frankly, that great a movie. I'm sorry. My apologies. It's kind of great.
What?
But it has one of the elements that Lucas does well in developing things.
Yeah.
And that is, whether by his design or someone else's, you have, like, all the people-sized people, if you will. All of, like, the general, normal 5-foot to 6-foot tall people.
The normies. You're wanting to say the normies.
The normies. All the regular people, Val Kilmer and company, are Dakini, I believe is the name of the humans.
And it sounds like Utini.
Oh, I never thought of that. Dakini! And the Nelwyn are the dwarves, and then I think that, there's some brownies that appear.
Girl Scouts?
Not precursors to Girl Scouts, nor delicious, very dense confections made with sweet, sweet chocolate, but actual mythical brownies from European folklore.
Gotcha, okay.
The sort of Scottish Gaelic... little tiny, 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 like put in your pocket people.
Gotcha.
And, but like Billy Barty has a starring role in it as a Nelwyn wizard. And here you have this guy who, starts out as just an extra as a kid in a costume. And all of a sudden the cameras are rolling and he actually delivers a damned good performance. I will say for his first speaking role.
Yeah.
I'm very impressed. That's one of the most impressive parts of this film is he brings everything to that. And I think a lot of it is the fact that Ron Howard is an insanely good director.
Yeah.
But, the best director can't, polish the turd that well. So he brings a lot to the table.
Yes.
And, you can see him cutting his teeth for future stuff in this. But, I mean, for effectively a nobody
uh-huh.
in a starring role, He brings a lot of stuff, and there's just cool little elements to it. Just to speak to Willow itself, like the Dakini referred to the Nelwyn as pecs, and I thought that was just a clever little like derogatory term.
Yeah,
like you know, like chickens could peck them.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, yeah.
Because they're so small. Because there's like a scene where he's wandering along, this horseman running out of the way, peck.
Gotcha.
And I like little layers that, you know, that's the extent of the exposition you get to that term.
Right.
And well, it comes up again later, but, you know, you don't need to have it explained to you.
Right.
I'm going to stop the film now and explain to you that peck is a derogatory term on the part.
Well, it sounds like he did with Willow in that respect what he did with Star Wars, and that he gave you a lived-in world that you didn't have to sit there and explain how everything worked. You filled in the blanks pretty easily.
And, of course, this film has one of the things that I hate, and I've seen it. We keep returning to it again and again and again. It happened in that attempt to do what could have been a really cool Lone Ranger franchise. And many other films and comics and such, where it's what I call castrating our heroes.
Yeah.
And in this case, Val Kilmer's character is proclaimed to be the greatest swordsman who ever lives and spends the first 2.5 acts of the film without a sword.
Gosh.
And it's like, you know, I don't need to see that.
Yeah, yeah.
The greatest swordsman that ever lived. Give me the greatest swordsman that ever lived.
Right. Speaking of Val Kilmer, he's Warwick Davis has a couple of kind of cool stories about Val Kilmer. He said here he was, this 17-year-old kid, and he was boarding the plane, as was all the cast, and they were flying them out to the location. And he says, being a 17-year-old kid, he couldn't afford real Ray-Bans sunglasses, so he had they said Ray-Bans, but he said they were, you know, the bootleg Ray-Bans.
Well, they were R&E. That's where Lucas got the idea for, or where Lucasfilm got the idea for Ray.
Oh, I kind of like that name, R-E-Y. I'm going to say that for later.
So here he goes. He's on the plane, and he's trying to be real cool about everything. He's got his bootleg Ray-Bans on, and he says, here comes Val Kilmer, you know, cool as ice self. He said he walks and he sees him sitting there and he stops and he looks at him. And he's obviously zeroed in on his sunglasses. He said he pulls them off his face, breaks them, drops them on the ground, and just kind of looks at him for a while. And Warwick Davis is like, oh my gosh, what do I do? Like, this is embarrassing. He said he reaches into either his bag or his coat jacket. I'm not sure which, because it's been a while since I've heard the story.
Yeah.
Puts out not one, but two pairs of real Ray-Bans, hands it to him and goes, these look a lot cooler. Use these. And he thought at that point,
that's so neat.
This is the coolest dude I've ever met. And then he has another story where, of course, being 17, he couldn't drive himself. He didn't have a car or anything. And Val wanted to meet him for dinner one night. And he told his mom, hey, can you drive me and drop me off at this whatever restaurant? And he said his mom, he said the type of car she drove, and I guess it's a known car over in England as kind of being like a beater. Like maybe it's like their version of the Gremlin or something that we had here, or the Pinto or whatever, that those little hatchback cars. Anyway, it's almost like just a little joke car, and he was always embarrassed of it. So he had her drop him off like around the corner from this restaurant because he didn't want Val Kilmer seeing the car. And so he walks in, and he says there's this other person sitting with Val Kilmer. And, he sees him across the way, and Val, you know, motions him over. He starts to walk over. He's like, who is this other person that's going to be joining us for dinner? Gets to the table. He says it's Tom Cruise.
Oh, wow.
He said so never in his life did he think he would, number one, meet Tom Cruise, but actually get to have dinner with Tom Cruise. So I thought that is awesome. He was just bringing that up to saying that how just, like, wonderfully blessed he has been, like, being in Star Wars was such a major magical thing in his life personally, but then it opened the doors to so many other awesome things after that for
exactly.
in his life.
Well, what's amazing is then, of course, you know, I think this was, yeah, it would have been after Willow, certainly. But, you know, the thing is, he goes on to do a film. I know you would will want to introduce this one.
Oh,
I'm sure you've seen it.
very much so.
Is there something like rhyme or something involved? Am I remembering that correctly? To invoke the character?
I think you're thinking Freddy Krueger or something.
Well, I thought it was like, you know, one of these things that sort of puts you in the mind of run as fast as you can. I'm Gingerbread Man.
Yeah.
I thought there was like some sort of rhyme. It's like, you know,
Actually, he does have a scene. And the movie series we're talking about is Leprechaun, of course.
Yeah.
And I did get my introduction to it very more recently. It's like Willow. It's on my must see list, but never got around to watching them. Thanks to our Talk of War of the Sith, Zach, he for Christmas this past year got me the first four movies on DVD. So I have been watching them, and oh my gosh, these movies are so much fun. So much fun to watch. But yeah, he does have some sort of saying that he's known to spout off.
Oh, I'm disappointed. I thought you could like just lead us right in with that.
No, I don't. If this,
but I didn't realize or remember that you had only had a recent entree.
Right. This was like Michael Myers. I could tell you anything about the Michael Myers Halloween movies, but you know, but Leprechaun is just fun. And again, he brings it in this role. I mean, he knows they're silly. He knows it's not to be taken seriously. And it very much plays it like the way Adam West played Batman.
Yes.
He took the role very seriously, knowing good and well it was all for comedic purposes. And I think that's why I really dig his Leprechaun character so much. He doesn't allow it to just be over-the-top silly. You know, he still maintains that aspect of, you know, like, don't get comfortable with me because I may bite you off type of character. And they're just fun. And of course, his mannerisms are there that you've come to learn to love. And just, you know, there's something that Tim Burton said about Michael Keaton, and I think it applies to Warwick Davis too. He's that certain type of actor where he can tell you about his character just in the way when you look into his eyes. And Warwick Davis, always having to wear this heavy prosthetic mask, that human character part of him really comes through in his eyes. It's hard to explain, but if you see the movie, you'll get what I'm saying. They're just great, great movies. I think he's done six of them. I think the rumor now is that, and fans are kind of ticked off about this, that they're rebooting the series and they're going to go with somebody different. And everyone's like, how can you have Leprechaun without Warwick Davis? When we actually still have Warwick Davis and he's in physical, you know, condition to actually play the role. It's like, why would
you? Yeah.
It's like the way people were irritated that Ron Perlman's not going to be Hellboy. It's like, he can still do Hellboy. Why don't you just have them do it? Anyways.
Yeah, I think that sort of falls into this weird kind of propriety that sets in. It's like, you know, this is our Hellboy or our Leprechaun. And then what's really cool is that Warwick Davis then parlays this new fame into co-creating with Peter Burroughs, another little person actor, the Willow Management.
Oh, okay.
Their tagline is the biggest agency for short actors in the world.
Oh, I haven't heard of this.
Oh, it is so neat. I love the fact that the man recognizes that, you know, there really wasn't an agency specific to little people with their interests in mind. And, you know, there's a lot of, I've heard like Peter Dinklage talk about how he passed on so many roles because he wasn't going to be one of those actors who just like took every little person job because it was a job.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was just sort of a personal choice. It doesn't discount those who do take that route because, you know, an actor acts. You know, sometimes you just have to take the shit jobs to get the good down the line, or you just suffer through till you get the good stuff and make it back for yourself.
Like degenerates and now hiring. you take the small roles.
We will take any role. You give.
We took the roles and it landed us the Rancor pit.
I was gone. I needed to work when I did. That's what she said. And I was an extra. I think that when I heard about it before Celebration, but he talked a little bit about it in his talk there. And I thought that is just so neat that he took that fame. You know, he was one of the goblins, I think, in the Harry Potter films at the Big Bank.
I thought he was like a professor something or other. I have not seen any of the movies.
You're right. He has played, I think in the first one, he was just a goblin.
Okay, he plays several roles, I guess. Yeah.
Exactly. And then, you know, going back to Star Wars even, he was in Episode One.
Right. As multiple roles. Weasel.
Well, originally he was cast as Wald, Anakin's Rodian friend.
Yeah, that's right. He's in the deleted scene, isn't he?
He's in the deleted scene with Greedo, but he's also in the pod race scenes.
That's
where
right.
he and the really other just terrible bad child actors.
The little wizard kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And apparently, as the story goes, he was hanging around on set just enjoying, you know, all the goings on, and Lucas looked over and says, "Go over to costume and makeup. You know, I need you to be in, you know, do something while you're here."
Right.
Something to that effect. And he says he goes into the makeup. He's like, "Make me different." And they put all these hair extensions on him and put him in a little Tatooine costume. And he winds up in Watto's box seat at the pod race.
Yeah.
Becomes known as Weasel. Mm-hmm. And then what's amazing, I didn't make the connection, even though I'd seen the character by name.
Yeah.
Is one of Enfys Nest's army.
Yeah.
Is none other than the same Weasel.
Yeah, the same character. I thought that was genius how they did that callback in Solo. And, of course, spoiler, the obvious one was Darth Maul. But that one went, like, largely unnoticed. It's like, we got Weasel again! What the heck?
I knew it was Davis, but
right.
I didn't know it was supposed to be Weasel.
I didn't know it until I knew he was in it, so I was just curious as to what his character's name was going to be, because when they started talking about potential figures, I thought, hey, I wonder if one of these names is his character. And when I looked it up, I thought, wait, he's got the same character. That's the same character from Phantom Menace. I couldn't believe it. I was like, that was pretty cool. It wasn't just like right there in your face. You know, they didn't feel the need to say, "Hey, Weasel, come over here and, you know, put the handcuffs on Han Solo" type thing. You know, they just were very subtle about it. And of course, he was in Rogue One.
Yeah.
As that big headed dude.
I don't know if he's supposed to be an Ugnaught or not, but he certainly came across like an Ugnaught.
Yeah, with the hydrocephalus Ugnaught or something.
It's like the Charlie Brown of Ugnaughts.
Ugnaught Brown. Like that. Oh my gosh.
Yeah,
but then one thing we've really come to learn in the past 8 years especially is how comfortable Warwick Davis is with his height, with his little person. And that's no more evident than his TV series Life's Too Short, where he plays a fictionalized version of himself.
Yes, this very highly fictionalized, very self-deprecating version.
Oh my
god. And they play upon his height so brilliantly.
Oh my god, then surround him
with the most amazing characters who just like his clueless assistant.
It's just
brilliant.
This show could only have been done overseas in England, because I don't think American TV is
The humor is insanely British. I mean, if you're British, you have got to see this because it is, and it really is Warwick Davis at the height of his powers as an actor because
he plays
so brilliantly straight. Have you seen the Washing Machine?
Yes, that's what I was going to bring up.
Oh my gosh. I just saw it today, and I was, oh my God.
That's the punchline in that scene. What I loved about that little bit was that really, like you were just talking about, he's like at the height of his acting powers. He gives those little subtle glances to the cameraman constantly, like.
Yeah, the thing is designed to be like a.
Like a reality TV show.
Like any of these reality shows where they're following somebody around. So you do get the breaking of the third wall rather repeatedly.
As the plumber's telling him, I was like, I can't unplumb that. You have to get another plumber to come unplumb it. And he's looking at he's just barely giving these little glances to the camera like, are y'all hearing this? Is he serious?
Is this real?
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Like, they could plumb in the new washer, but they can't unplumb the old one.
Right, and they can't plumb the new one in until he gets the other one plumbed out. It is,
and then the whole idea of no good deed goes unpunished is very much in that.
Oh my gosh, there's so many just golden moments in this show, and you were talking about it. A lot of it really plays, the jokes are played on his height.
Yeah.
This is one scene I die laughing every time I watch it is he's in the grocery store and he meets a fan.
Oh my God.
And they exchange numbers and they start making plans to go out on a date. Well, she checks out first. He goes to check out and one of the things he's put into his basket, assumingly after making plans to go on this date, is a box of condoms. So the cashier proceeds to say, are these going to fit you? And he's like, yes, yes, they're fine. Fine, just, you know, no, I don't think these are going to fit you. We don't want to get sued if these don't fit you. They don't work. Then she turns to the other cashier who's several feet away and exclaims out loud, do you think these are going to fit him?
Queued up to check out, no less.
Right. It's like, do you think these are going to fit him? And it's like, he is just like beyond mortified. Then he turns around and sees the girl is still in there in this, and she's witnessing all this and she's got this horrible look on his face and he goes, no, I'm not planning this for you. And he's like trying to like get himself
trying to backpedal and it's just he's like, no, it could be there for anybody. And everything he says is the wrong thing to say in the moment.
He keeps trying to fix himself to the point where he even says, you know, it's like, you know, you just gotta be careful nowadays. I mean, my stuff's clean, but I don't know. Oh, you know, he points toward her crotch. He goes, I don't know about yours. I mean, you know, I'm sure it's fine. He's like, it's just genius. And it's like,
it just snowballs. And then
it's just so much energy in that scene. I love it. I love it.
One of the other ones I saw was he's trying to get pick up some girl in a bar. And he's trying to get his friend to be the wingman and, you know, it's like a real customer. He's, you know, just go tell them I'm a bad, you know, girls like bad guys. They don't want a bad boy. They don't want a good guy like me. So I need you to go and just, you know, tell them how bad I am. And they're like, well, how's he bad? He's a rapist. The worst choice this guy could have made. And of course that he has to run over and exclaim, no, not rapist. I'm a racist. And of course one of the rapists, the black woman.
That's slightly not as bad.
and then he's, because one of the two women is a black woman, then he has to explain that, no, he's racist and that he would do her and not her white friend.
Yes. He goes, but then eventually I probably would want to do you both.
they play this beautiful, growing awkwardness. But gee. And it is, if you haven't seen, I'm trying to try it now where I can see the entire thing or rent the entire season.
But it's an HBO series, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong, though.
Absolutely. Some of the most brilliant stuff. Then I also happened to watch Ricky Gervais did a show. I think it was called The Idiot Abroad.
Oh, I love that show. I was watching it before they brought in Warwick Davis, but once they brought him in, it just got 10 times better.
Him and Gervais are old pals or something, and that, and I think Ricky Gervais had something to do with Life's Too Short as well in the production of it, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, he did.
The idea was that Ricky Gervais has this friend who's just vacuous and dull-witted and worldly, and he wants to, like, send him all over the world and kind of broaden his horizons. And this guy
you're talking about, he's the type that has no filter. Like, yeah, he says out loud the things that you and I only think but don't want to say out loud.
Exactly. That's a good point. And this one I saw was them shopping for a trip to Borneo to go camp.
Oh, yeah.
It's like at one point he's like got Gervais on the phone. He's like, you know, he wants to go camping. He's like so small. He wants to go see an orangutan. I don't know how those animals act. They might not know what to think of him. He's so small. You know? See the black and white. They don't even know. They think he's one of them.
Are you serious? Oh my gosh!
What?
Oh my gosh!
Just so you know, I am what I am, and I'm going to have fun with that.
Yeah,
I don't have to be bitter about the cards I've been dealt. I can, and in poking fun at the way, a lot of it is kind of poking fun at the awkwardness that people have when they don't know what to say, and then juxtapose that with a guy who doesn't think about what to say.
Right, exactly. And he says he encounters that all the time where people are obviously trying not to use the word little or short in just casual conversation with them, and in doing so they keep saying little and short. And
yeah, I only got a short, I know your time is short. And
yes, and then they catch themselves as if they're putting them down purposely or something. He's like, he doesn't care, he says.
But it's some brilliant, brilliant stuff there. So if you get a chance, check out some of Warwick Davis's comedic work. He is absolutely his actions are just so genuine. You know, it's obviously a scripted show, or probably I would imagine there's some ad lib elements as well. But
oh sure,
in the end, when we saw him speak at Celebration, he had shown a clip where he's trying to have a peephole put in the door of his apartment.
Oh, yes. I've seen those.
And the guy, you know, puts it in at his eye level, and he's just so about it, and, you know, it looks perfect, and the top where it originally was has been rendered pristine, and then they try it out, and he's like, all I can see is your crotch. He's, well, that's, you know, he's, well, I thought I could, like, you know, look up and see your face.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the ultimate, the...
it's a periscope or something.
Yeah, but the ultimate solution is nothing short of both brilliant and hilarious.
Oh, my gosh.
And I think it was, if I'm not mistaken, maybe Ricky Gervais was coming over, but it has that kind of Fawlty Towers feel where everything just...
Yes.
If you're a fan of Fawlty Towers, you would absolutely love this because...
Oh, yeah.
It does just that. It snowballs.
And Fawlty Towers is my all-time favorite British comedy. I love Fawlty Towers. We watch it almost on a monthly basis.
Order, such as we carried out.
So, talking about how comfortable he is with his height, you know, if you get a chance, just on YouTube, do a search for interviews with him, because I love hearing him talk. He tells the best stories. Like one time he was talking about it in grade school. They were taking woodshop for the semester, and everyone got to choose whatever they got to make. And, you know, some people chose to make stools, some people chose to make end tables, what all. And he chose to make stilts.
Brilliant.
And what the thing is, he said, but if you don't stop to think about how to produce stilts, he said it's literally just two posts with two little pieces of wood bolted into the sides.
Yeah.
He said, and that's it. He said, I had to manage to draw this project out for a whole semester. In order, it's like everyone else is like taking their time and like, you know, sanding down their stools and, you know, giving it shape and smoothness. He basically picked a project that anybody could have finished in an hour.
Exactly.
But he had to manage to stretch it up like a whole semester.
Oh, that is... And see, yeah, this sort of illustrates the brilliance and you know, the path to becoming the star of Life's Too Short.
And, right, right. And there's another... And
creating this, having that sense of humor even from a very early age.
Oh, exactly. And he tells, like, a cautionary tale to his fellow little people that when you go into a public restroom, make sure before you put the soap in your hand that you can actually reach the sink to actually wash your hands, because it's been a long time. He went to the soap.
Oh my!
And got the you know, not the foaming hand soap, but like the traditional white, you know,
kind of pearlescent white.
Yes, pearlescent white. And he realizes he goes to the sink, realizes he can't reach it. So then he doesn't know what to do with the soap. So he's got this cup in his hand. And he says a gentleman walks in, sees him standing there with this like deer in the headlights look, cupped hand with this goo in his hand. He goes, "Mate, that's disgusting."
It's terrible.
I love it. I love it.
Well, that is brilliant and terrible all at once.
Well, that's just, that's why I just love the sense of humor. Yeah. That's exactly. Why I encourage people to go look up interviews with him just to hear his stories. They're just one after another, just amazing, amazing, well-told tales of him dealing with being in a world where nothing is built to his height. You know?
Exactly. And I think with that, we should wrap up. This has been an amazing journey through something we haven't done in a long time, and that's the actor profile.
Yeah. Well, we kind of did it with the Hammer one. That wasn't too long ago, but that's true.
We
just
doubled
a single it. Actor. Yeah, we did double dip a little bit. One thing I wanted to bring in, one last thing before we exit out, it's a very important aspect of Warwick Davis. I just found out in this past few days in researching for this episode, he has produced and is hosting a documentary. It's called The Seven Dwarfs of Auschwitz. And I have not heard of the story, and I am so eager to find this.
I mean, I'm not kidding. When you mentioned the title and everything, I literally got those weird kind of chills you get when something just really strikes you.
Right, and that's when I heard it the same way, when I reacted to it, and I was like, oh my gosh, what is this? And I immediately perked up when he started to talk about it. What this documentary is that he's done is about the, I think it's Awicz family. It's a Jewish family of two men, five women, and they were all little people, and they were all entertainers in Germany. They were musicians. They did stage comedy, you know, like they were apparently a well-known traveling group of entertainers. And so when the World War started, of course, two strikes against them, they were Jewish and they were physically unfit.
Yeah, so they were.
Of course, and they were apparently, and of course I have not seen the documentary, so I don't know the little details. Some of them I'm just assuming. They were apparently scheduled to go be gassed, unfortunately, as the horrors of the Holocaust are. And either on the way or after it had already been scheduled for them to be gassed, well-known doctor Joseph Mengele had heard about them and was so intrigued that he had them brought over to his facility so he could perform experiments on these seven family members.
Good Lord.
And in doing so, inadvertently saved their lives. I mean, again, I haven't seen the documentary, but I think all seven come out alive. I don't know. Warwick Davis says that this is really a tale of hope. Hope in the midst of this horrible thing that's going on.
Yes.
And the things that were performed on them were just unspeakable by this.
Oh, God. Yeah. Mengele was insane.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very much so. And he said, but that was ultimately what kept them from immediately going to the death chambers was that his curiosity about his weirdness. And so I'm going to definitely look up the Seven Dwarfs of Auschwitz. And it seems like such an amazing story that seems to be, needs to be told.
Absolutely.
But anyways, yeah, this was a good episode.
And it just struck me the other day, I was thinking about, I don't even, I may have even been thinking about Willow of all things. And it suddenly occurred to me, you know, Warwick Davis is a fascinating character as an actor and as a person in the greater Star Wars story.
Yeah.
We really do need to talk about this man and his career and just the amazing turns of fate that led to him becoming who he is today.
Oh, yeah. Who would have thought? It all started with his grandmother simply just seeing a call for extras in a newspaper. And it's brought him, opened up a whole new world to him. He literally took his first steps into a larger world.
Oh, very good. Well, with that, we got to end on that. That's all, folks. That's one of these things hit at the end of the show where it belongs, so we can close on it. But, again, thank you, Eddie. Thank you to everybody for continuing to keep the Rancor Pit a part of our little corner of the Star Wars saga, or the story of Star Wars, as it were.
Yeah.
Just amazed where it's taken us, and it's not been certainly a major path, but we were just doing this for the hell of it.
and the funny thing is, we still are.
Yeah, exactly. So when something does come our way, we're all the more gracious for it. So we do hope to see you. We're already working on our plans for our second roadshow tour, which will happen in 2019. We decided to do it every other year.
So y'all don't get sick of us.
Sometimes we get sick of us. We don't want that to happen. So be on the lookout for more about that coming up in the near future, and we will be back here very soon with more Simple Tricks and Nonsense on the Rancor Pit.
Nub Nub. This awesome music is provided by Ray Reezy. That's R-E-Y-R-Z-Y. You can find him on Instagram and SoundCloud. On Instagram, it's at R-E-Y-R-Z-Y. And on SoundCloud, it's soundcloud.com/R-E-Y-R-Z-Y. You can also contact him at rayreezymusic@gmail.com. Make sure you check out this guy's stuff. It's really awesome. Thanks for listening, and may the Force be with you.